You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello and welcome to a new edition of the Russian Orthodox Nationalists. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. This edition is being recorded very late on the 7th of June, 2025. I hope my air conditioner in the background isn't a problem. I do need it whenever it gets over 65 degrees because I hate the heat. But today, especially for those of you who have been following the now, I think, 45 episodes we've done on Solzhenitsyn's 200 years together, the revolution of 1905 has come up several times, and it's been mentioned, although not in any detail, the infamous mutiny on the battleship Potemkin, which took place almost exactly 120 years ago, almost to the day, actually. June 14th to June 28th, 1905, and was actually a big part of that revolution, and it's gone down. It's a failed revolution, of course, but very important in terms of the left, and especially the Jews of places like Odessa, in understanding what they had to do to take over. It was a very significant event. And at least, especially in the eyes of the West, who, you know, we're getting the most ridiculous information. We'll talk about that in a second. Believing that even their military wanted nothing to do with the Tsarist system. So it's up to me yet again to show that that's simply not true. And a lot of this has to do with the Black Sea port city of Odessa. That was one of the centerpieces, as well as Moscow, Kiev, and Petersburg, of the 1905 revolution. Odessa is, at the time, was a full third, if not more, Jewish. The left has taken this mutiny as proof, the unpopularity of the Tsar and the state system in general. Of course, it's not even close to being true. Now, the nonsense that you hear, at least some of it, comes from as far back as 1925. Because that's when the movie Battleship Potemkin came out, an early Soviet propaganda film by the famous director Sergei Eisenstein. He kind of adapted what had already been a make-believe fairy tale the Soviet party officials had come up with long before 1917. Soviet propaganda rarely had any even accidental connection to reality. This movie may have been slightly, there may have been an accidental connection with reality. Usually propaganda has to have just enough truth to make it vaguely plausible. They even go so far as to say this is the first time that an entire military unit rebelled against the crown, which isn't true regardless. And that film, of course, became very famous, or infamous, and it solidified the myth of the revolution and the revolutionaries. We'll get to all of this here pretty soon. The force-feeding of sailors rotten meat, the fighting between sailors and reactionary officers who tried to shoot them just because they didn't want to eat that, romanticizing the alleged leader of the uprising, Grigory Vekolenchuk. His movie, and a lot of the propaganda coming from it, still informs Western nonsense on this mutiny today. In fact, I had to take some antacids and go to the history.com site, which also has not even an accidental connection with reality, But let me give you their summary, and that's essentially the Leninist summary. The Potemkin uprising was sparked by a disagreement over food, but it was anything but accidental. Morale in Russia's Black Sea Fleet had long been at rock bottom, spurred on by defeats of the Russo-Japanese War and widespread civil unrest at the home front. Many Navy ships were teeming with revolutionary sentiment and animosity towards the aristocratic officer class. One of the Potemkin's least radicals was a financi, Matyushenko, a fiery quartermaster known for railing against the brutal discipline of Navy life. In early June 1905, he and Potemkin crewman Gregory Vakulinchuk joined with other disgruntled sailors in plotting a fleet-wide mutiny. Their audacious plan called for the rank and file to rise up and strike a concerted blow against the officers. After commandeering all the Navy ships in the Black Sea, the conspirators would enlist the peasant class in a revolt that would sweep the Tsar, misspelled, Nicholas II from the Russian throne. That's the official line. Again, there's just enough truth in there to make it fly. And they didn't say, like, it happened on Venus or something like that. But remember, this is the same website that has an article that has the title, Did Perestroika Play a Role in the Fall of the USSR? But the article, and what I just quoted to you, is taken straight from Lenin's own propaganda. It's, to be very nice about it, a highly idealized version of things, accepted in American universities. It's not just false, it is a deliberately crafted lie. The peasant class was never meant to be a part of the revolution, even in theory. Lenin, in no way could Lenin have thought that, even though he would say it. And certainly the workers wanted nothing to do with the Red Movement. And it wasn't expected. But let me quote someone who has a better grasp of reality. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, from the very same book we're dealing with elsewhere, 200 years together. However, after the Kishinev pogrom, Western opinion had firmly become established in the attitude of repulsion towards Russia, considered as an old saw, an Asiatic and despotic country where obscurantism reigns, where the people are exploited, where the revolutionaries are treated without pity, subjected to inhuman sufferings and deprivations, and now they're massacring Jews by the thousands. And behind all of this, there is a hand of the government. As we have seen, the government was unable to rectify this distorted version of the facts in time with any energy and efficiency. So in the West, people began to consider it appropriate, even worthy of consideration, to hope that the revolution would break out in Russia as soon as possible. It would be a good thing for the whole world, and for the Jews of Russia in particular. See, throughout this period of time, the Tsarist government knew it was constantly being watched. It had no friends in the Western world, and in the Eastern world to some extent, too. The British Empire saw both Prussia and Russia as a constant threat. And the Jewish issue was one of the reasons. I've said a million times that the West did not support the state, whether it be Kerensky's or the royal state, at any point and for any reason. Of course, it supported the Kerensky movement when it opposed the monarchy, but certainly not during the Civil War. It firmly bet on the Bolsheviks, and this is part of the reason why. Now, let's talk about the movement itself, and he's talking about the Bolshevik movement, or really the leftist movement of 1905. And this is even more instructive. And by the way, when I'm reading this, he's quoting a lot of Jewish historians and writers, both now and at the time. This isn't all his words, but he's quoting important Jewish writers on the matter. The new generation of revolutionaries had emerged at the turn of the 20th century. Its leaders, Gregory Grishuny and Mikhail Gotz, had decided to revive the terrorist methods of the Will of the People organization. Grishuny took upon himself the heavy responsibility of creating in Russia a new revolutionary party called to succeed with dignity the will of the people. And thanks to his talents as an organizer, as well as to those of other revolutionaries devoted to the cause, this party was born at the end of the year 1901. At the same time, it also constituted its armed faction. Its creator and inspirer was none other than the very same Grishuny. Among the social revolutionaries, SRs, the Jews immediately played a leading role. Among them were Ansky Rapoport, K. Jutlowski, Osip Minor, Ivan Rubanovich, and Mark Natanson. The armed faction included among its members Abraham Gotz, Dora Brilliant, Dibbleberg, and of course the infamous Azef. It is among the SRs that Trillister was also found, who later became part of the Cheka. And he's quoting here, "Among the grassroots activists of the SRs, there were also quite a few Jews. They never represented a tiny minority." That's Shub, Jewish writer. According to him, that's even the most Russian of the revolutionary parties. For security reasons, the seat of the party was transferred abroad. For example, the Bund was absent in Geneva, at Gotz, at elsewhere. Well, regardless of that claim, there's not a non-Jewish name I mentioned. Solzhenitsyn is quoting people like Kroll, Schlossberg, Schlub. All were vaguely sympathetic to the revolution in one form or another, whether they be Zionist or leftist. And they were working together at the time anyway. And these groups were fairly small to begin with. And wherever they were, they had to force themselves onto the workers they pretended to represent. But the Jews at the time were the best armed group in Ukraine, especially, as well as Moscow. So any talk of a pogrom is propaganda. Lenin made a show to speak of the Jewish workers in a 1905 article to make it appear his movement was not an ethnic one. I think Lenin existed to lessen the Jewish top-heavy nature of that Red Movement. The protest began because of poor quality food, or so the story goes. A few sailors seized the ship during naval target practice, killing a few officers. Without a clear plan for future action, the rebels took the ship to Odessa, where they intended to replenish supplies of coal, water, and food, support the anti-government protests already taking place in the city, and meet with the other ships of the Black Sea Fleet and encourage them to join the uprising. But even that is false. But whatever ideological motives there were, the plans of the rebels didn't work out. The battleship, having fled to Constanta, a coastal city in the Black Sea in Romania, from there made a trip to Feodosia off the Crimean coast, and then back again, surrendering to the Romanian authorities 11 days later. Now that's the story in a nutshell there. But clearly, as I quoted from the History.com article, you know, they're claiming that this was one of the things that would eventually topple the Tsar later on, that this is a major event in what they consider to be an already struggling Russian Empire. Now, what was a Potemkin? And it's very important to understand this. It was a Petropavlovsk-class battleship. It was state-of-the-art for the time. Started in 1897 when it was laid down, the Nikolaev Admiralty Shipyard, October 1898. It was launched in 1900 and transferred to Sevastopol in the Crimea for fitting in July 4th, 1902. Her sea trials began in 1903, and it took a long time, right until 1905, where her weapons turrets were completed. The battleship was very important. It was the first to use centralized artillery fire control, set from a single post located in the ship's conning or command and control tower. It was the first ship in the Russian fleet with liquid fuel boilers. Now, the ship's construction took longer than planned due to a fire in the boiler room during construction, and there are other defects that were discovered along the way in the armor of the main caliber gun turrets. The Potemkin was equipped with a raised forecastle, which reduced the flooding of the ship's bow in rough seas and raised the axis of the main caliber bow guns to 7.6 meters above the water surface. In order to strengthen the artillery armament, in comparison with the prototype, more advanced armor with increased resistance was used in the Potemkin. Its thickness was reduced, and therefore its weight, but it was stronger. This battleship was the first in the Black Sea Fleet to be equipped with cranes for lifting boats and launches. The ship's armor was advanced for the time, with design taking into account the impact of enemy artillery, mines, torpedo weapons, etc. It had armor protection of vital objects, including a vertical external anti-projectile armor on the sides and its structures, and horizontally, an armored deck with slopes made of new extra-soft nickel space steel, just mastered and created by the Azora plant in Russia, first used on the cruiser Diana. Artillery mounts, mines, and conning towers were also armored. Trucks for underwater protection from mines and torpedoes were also provided. And it had very advanced and powerful artillery for the time. Guns of the main, medium, or the anti-mine, and small calibers, installed on the entire length of the ship, in the forecastle, the main deck, the bow, and stern sections, as well as on the fighting top of the foremast. Machine guns were located on the special platform, the main level. The main caliber guns, though, were four 305mm guns with 40 caliber barrels installed on two turrets, bow and stern. The mass of one such gun was 43 tons, and the rate of fire was impressive for the time, 0.75 rounds per minute, so not quite a round a minute. And they were loaded using electric mechanisms. The ammunition load of one main caliber gun consisted of 60 305mm shells, 18 armor-piercing, 18 high-explosive, 4 segmented, 18 cast iron, and 2 grapeshot. To be noted straight away, though, and this is very important, that this was a threat to British interests. This was a Russian-made battleship of the first rank that can easily challenge the British anywhere. So any nonsense about the Russians not being able to make this kind of thing is absolute garbage. This was made exclusively in Russia, and Russia had no reason to trust anybody, regardless. So that was a ship. It was a very important piece of equipment. Remember, this is going on during the Russo-Japanese War. The mutiny that we're going to talk about here, which was fanned by the leftist press, had tremendously negative consequences right in the middle of the Russo-Japanese War, something itself that was provoked by the West. The British especially invested massively both in the revolutionary movement as well as the Japanese and Turkish navies. Now, I've written and shown many times that the war, that is to say the Russo-Japanese War, was hardly a defeat for the Russians. It wasn't a victory either. The media invented stories of Russia's humiliating defeats, despite the fact that it was seen as a defeat in Japan. The Japanese media said that we have been defeated. Japan was using 100% of its military power, where Russia was barely present in that obscure part of the world. It's fair to say that the war was a draw. But the entire revolution of 1905 was driven by false reports of a humiliating defeat against the Japanese. And after all, Russian military leadership considered the Far Eastern theater to be secondary. Plans for military and naval construction were to be completed only by the middle or end of 1905. At the beginning of the war, Russia was totally unprepared for anything. The newest Russian battleships, Potemkin being one of them, that was, you know, being built in the Black Sea, but others were being built in the Baltic. The Port Arthur fortress wasn't finished. The Siberian Railway wasn't prepared quite yet for high-capacity items. You didn't have a whole lot of infantry available in the Far East. All of that harmed the war effort. But, of course, Japan was ready for it. It was in its backyard. I mean, Japan relied on fleet superiority very close to its home base, making it possible at the beginning of the war to damage the Russian flotilla at Port Arthur. Japanese plan sought the capture, encirclement, and destruction of the Russian army, so speed and surprise were paramount. The destruction of Russian ground forces at a cost didn't impede their further aggressive expansion in the east as their ultimate goal in the war, but this wasn't accomplished. By Japanese standards, the war was a failure. It can't be called a victory for Japan for that reason. The uprising that we're talking about was preceded by the surrender of the fortress of Port Arthur. The very beginning of the year, not to mention the Bloody Sunday on January 9th, the murder of Grand Duke Sergei Alexandrovich, the bloody battle for Mukden, today called Shenyang in Manchuria, that was in March, the actual defeat at Tsushima in May, and then you had rumors spreading around among sailors serving in the Black Sea region that it may be sent out there. And the sailors' fears of this became a convenient ground for revolutionary agitation. The point being that the Russians performed extremely well under the circumstances. It took, if you remember my lecture on the Russo-Japanese War, 6 or 7 times before Port Arthur had been surrendered. And even then, it really didn't have to be. It was a miscommunication. The Japanese losses were monumental. And the Russians had essentially one hand tied behind their backs the entire time. But the left is an extremely deceptive, violent group of people. It was heavily Jewish, as we know, especially in Ukraine, but elsewhere too. And they were using the war as a starting off point. And the fear of men being sent to the Far East, of course, was something that they also used. Now, the Black Sea had been a heavily Jewish region. Jews predominated in the area. It was a part of the Khazar Empire. Since the beginning of the 20th century, the communist cells began to appear in and around that region. It did attempt to penetrate the Navy there. It had limited success. But we know it was heavily Jewish. It was confined to this area. No other ship did anything like this. So in April 1904, a whole bunch of these Jewish groups united into a single underground organization. They called themselves Social Democrats, but it was just called the Sevastopol Party Organization, or Sevastopol Central. Now, Lenin called the Third Congress of the RSDLP, or the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. The Bolsheviks came from that, which, of course, was held in London in April of 1905. The Bolsheviks alone were the only ones who were there. Their policy was to create an armed uprising. So the Sevastopol Central in Crimea was tasked with creating a general uprising in the Black Sea Fleet, planned for the autumn of 1905. Knowing full well that this was a very Jewish area, they had many supporters there. The coastal cities were teeming with them, especially in Odessa. Lenin at the time was in Geneva. But regardless even of that, the support didn't exist in the military. There was some legitimate unrest and worry among sailors and Marines in the Black Sea region, especially about being sent to war. You had some hostility. The battleship Ekaterina II and Tri Spasitelte forced the Central Committee to move the start of the uprising to the summer of 1905. But Potemkin was seen as the most conservative ship, the least able to produce a revolutionary result. So the events that occurred there during its training firing was very unexpected. The Central Committee was completely confused by the whole thing, and so it certainly wasn't led by them at all, which Lenin, of course, would later claim. Most of the strikes that you hear about in Russia in the 20th century were usually done by force. Now, there were some legitimate ones. I've talked about those too. But in Ukraine, it wasn't the case. In Odessa, a general strike was organized by the Jewish self-defense units. This was the armed Jewish Revolutionary Guard. They forced these strikes. They were going to destroy the factories if they didn't do it. They had no support among what they call the proletariat. Within a month, it did, however, paralyze city life. Most workers were forced to join the strike by threats, beatings, and sent some were shot. And the state, as always, mishandled the enforcement. Cossacks were brought into the city. They patrolled the streets together with reinforced police units. Remember, the Russian police were not very large, and they certainly weren't prepared for anything like this. Jews were better armed than they were, and they received firearms illegally from abroad, from Britain, and they were willing to fight them head-on, especially in Odessa. At the time, the Jews were organized in Odessa into the Bolshevik Committee and the Menshevik faction, and they, along with the Jewish Bund, they created the United Commission, which was an entirely Jewish enterprise. Essentially, it was a mafia front with a name like Commission. There was another forced strike at the Johann Gen Agricultural Machinery Plant, And when the police broke it up, they arrested several Jews. This is on June 13th. The Jewish mob then followed the arrested to the police station, demanding their release, chanting all kinds of vicious slurs against the church and the Tsar, doing everything they could to be as provocative as possible. Cossacks had to be called in for that, and there were some injuries. Cossacks fired live ammunition into the crowd, knowing that the self-defense units were nearby, killing two. But of course, as far as the West was concerned, the leftist press was saying that there were 5,000 slaughtered or something like that. After that, clashes between Jews against the police, military units, and Cossacks began throughout the city. And it was the same as on Bloody Sunday in Petersburg. The organizers of the riots deliberately shot at Cossacks. They dropped bombs from the windows. They were well-armed. Jews, both Zionists and leftists. And they had the full support of the West. The evening of June 14th, a bomb was thrown from a passing carriage at a Cossack detachment on one of the squares, Subotnaya Square, killing one policeman. On June 15th, there was an attempt to rob gun shops. The Alexandrovsky Prospect, or Main Avenue. This was at the height of the riots. The battleship Prince Potemkin appeared in Odessa, captured by its rebellious crew. Now, due to prolonged contact with the Jews at the ship's repair yards, they certainly weren't workers. You did have a handful, and Lenin had prepared this, as we've already mentioned, you did have a handful corrupted by revolutionary agitation, though then their motives always differed. The battleship's captain received anonymous letters warning of this rebellion. And as a result, he discharged 50 sailors. Now, of that group, they had submitted a petition to be discharged because they were fearful of what might happen. But he also discharged 40 more that he was worried about in terms of reliability. Now, keep in mind that the main port of the ship was Sevastopol, not Odessa. They went to Odessa to take advantage of the Jewish and leftist violence there. Now, you have to understand the circumstances. The crew, this was a humongous ship, of course. 731 people, 26 officers. However, at the time when she went out to sea, it was up to 781 sailors, 15 officers, two doctors, and a priest. Now, the increase compared to what was normal was due to the fact that a large number of stokers and engine drivers' apprentices were taken out to sea. Younger sailors from the 1904 draft got on board only in the spring of 1905. That was almost 30% of the total number. Together with the conscripts of the previous 2 years, remember service in the Navy was 7 back then, they were also considered young sailors. Their share was 56% more. Of those who had been around a while, 16%. Experienced sailors who remained to serve in the Navy after the required 7 years had expired. So this crew was very experienced and very young. For the overwhelming majority of sailors, the Potemkin was their first place of service. Only a handful, really 80, I think, of the 781 had served on other ships in the Russian fleet. Now, the number of officers on the ship that went out for firing practice was lower than the authorized number because there was a shortage of officers during the war. So the officers that they had with them were either inexperienced or actually civilian sailors who had been drafted into the Navy on a temporary basis. So you had a handful of officers and a shortage of experienced officers reduced the ability to deal with the crew even on the best of circumstances. Now, according to the police department of Odessa, and there was trials, of course, after all of this, 24 men from the battleship's crew took part in revolutionary movement, and they knew about the impending uprising within the Black Sea fleet. This is a very small number. So when does it start? June 12th, 1905. So we're talking about almost exactly 120 years ago. The battleship, which always had a smaller destroyer that was supposed to set up her targets, left Sevastopol in Crimea, and the next morning arrived at Tundrovskaya Island, about 100 nautical miles from Odessa, which is the normal location for these things. On June 13th, the battleship's captain, Yevgeny Gulikov, sent its torpedo boat 267 to Odessa to purchase provisions, and this is where the problems began. 13th, the ship's auditor, midshipman Makarov, accompanied by their butler, two crewmen and a couple of cooks were sent on the torpedo boat 267 to buy provisions. Now, because there was a general strike in the city at the time, most of the shops were closed and the market was empty. So Makarov knew somebody. He took everyone to a shop, but someone he knew, the merchant Kapilov, and there was meat there. Now, the butler and the cooks noticed that there were little white worms on the meat that was present, so the group left. Later, the sailors, having wandered around the entire market for a while, didn't find anything else, or if they found something else, it was very overpriced. And they had to buy other things. So they ended up going back to Kapilov and bought 28 poods of that same beef. Now, what were those little white worms? They were maggots. Now remember the time period here. Just be very careful. Maggots were not an indicator that the meat had gone bad. There were no refrigerators at the time. The flies managed to lay eggs in meat during transportation. They laid eggs wherever they could. White worms were common then, even in the freshest meat. I don't like thinking about it. We associate it with rotten meat, but that wasn't the case without refrigeration. Every cookbook of the era said if you have meat, you rinse it in salt water or brine immediately after purchase, which, by the way, the cook did when he returned to the ship. According to the store clerk, Vorobyov, the meat was from a slaughter on June 12th, so it was the freshest meat available. So the meat lay in the first store all day and then the night aboard the torpedo boat. In the morning, the next day, the officers on watch testified that it was a little stale. Now, I checked the Russian translation. That's exactly what they said. That's not rotten. It's not bad. It just had been left out. So, on the morning of June 14th, so this is fresh meat, however you slice it. No pun intended. Half the meat brought onto the battleship was put in a cauldron, and they were making borscht out of it, which is pretty normal. What was remaining was hanging on the spar deck for airing. 5 a.m., reveille, they were discovered by other sailors. The rumors then flew that, quote, stale meat had been purchased. And things got worse. It was rotten. There were maggots because it was rotten. It smelled bad. You're going to get sick if you eat, like telephone, like high school girls. It got worse. And this is what happened. With these young kids who were very susceptible to that kind of thing. So you had bad weather. The shooting practice was postponed to the next day. Now, signal for dinner was given. You know, back then, you had to put yourself on the list of drinkers. You had to sign your name if you're a drinker, if you're not. Vodka was there for the crew. You had to enter yourself in the list of drinkers. The butler poured a dinner glass for all such sailors who lined up with a measuring mug. And they drank vodka right there on the deck. Now, normally, the ship's commander, the ship's captain, or the officer on the watch took a sample of the cooked dinner. That was a custom. It was almost a ritual. So the borscht was examined by the battleship's doctor, Sergei Smirnov, who said it's fine. But it had been washed in brine and salt water. It was nothing on it. But the rumors had spread by this point, and they refused to take it. They ate crackers, whatever else they could. And the captain, Gulikov, wanted to get to the bottom of this because everyone was angry now. So the battleship's crew lined up on the poop deck or the upper stern on the starboard and port side. Line officers had to be there, and other engineers and mechanics, they were still in the wardroom. Now, almost all Russian historians are unanimous. The story is that the crew rebelled because they tried to feed him Boris with rotten meat. It's not true. And they blame the officers for this. They mistreated sailors. There's a book out called The Black Sea Fleet and Three Wars and Three Revolutions by A.B. Shielkrat, who talks about that bunch who went out onto shore stealing money, plundering the cash register, and covering their tracks, decided to buy low-quality food since it wasn't enough for quality food. Either way, it wasn't rotten meat. And it kept spreading. So on the 14th, before lunch, someone from the crew told the quartermaster sailor, Lutsev, who was on watch, that the Boris was made from bad meat. Again, this started all over again. The remains of the beef that was hanging on the spar deck were re-examined in the presence of the midshipman, Monakov, and the same Dr. Smirnov. And they found the meat. I checked the translation here. Fresh enough, it just needed another rinse with brine. That was reported to the officer on the watch. Three people who actually saw it and looked at it said the soup was fit for consumption. Anyone who said otherwise hadn't even tried it. It's a very interesting psychological method here. So having come out to the sailors, the ship's captain called the doctor from the wardroom, and yet again he went down to examine the Boris. He said for the second time, "It's fine." He said that the crew, you know, was being treated too well here. They were getting away with things they shouldn't. Then the captain got very upset. He threatened the sailors with punishment for mutiny. After that, mostly the NCOs, the conductors, boatswains loyal to the authorities, they clearly were on the captain's side. But some were stubborn. And now you're on the verge of mutiny, all based on rumor. Those who were thinking of mutiny had wavered. 30 were remaining, and the guards were called. Now, the men who were arrested by the guards were not the instigators of the mutiny. That drove the sailors who had already submitted to the will of the captain out of obedience, and the historian Kirchenkov focused on this. It wasn't the revolutionary ideas of the social democrats or even stale meat. The mutiny began when the sailors suspected the battleship's captain was going to punish innocent men. That wasn't true either. But that was the understanding, a tremendous amount of miscommunication. Now, one of the senior officers gave an order to bring a tarp from the 16-oared launch boat. And it was misinterpreted. When you talk about the worst possible interpretation, taking a tarp meant he was going to, everyone said he was going to wrap bodies in it, because that is how the bodies were wrapped. So you had calls for resistance, complete miscommunication at this point. Now, I'm not sure what the tarp was for. It could have been for anything. But they took it in the worst possible way. They were already in trouble. And this is when the sailors rush into the battery room. They broke open the lockers with the rifles and cartridges. And that's where the actual mutiny began. After the outbreak of this, the captain again summoned all the officers to the poop deck through messenger. And this is where things get foggy. Some of the officers didn't want to deal with this. They knew that certain sailors were armed. They pretended to give excuses. They didn't want to go. Of 16 regular officers on the ship, only 10 actually gathered with the captain. But the number of loyal sailors continued to increase. When the captain himself tried to enter the battery room, the weapons room, he was met at the door by a loaded rifle. Now you have a critical situation. Everyone else was unarmed. The handful of those involved in mutiny were inside and armed. The guard did have loaded weapons. He ordered them to stand in front of both exits from the battery and to shoot anyone who tried to approach anyone with a rifle. The guard was frightened. They were young, and they hesitated. So, the captain then gave the signalman an order to call the destroyer, which was always with it as a support ship, for assistance. Now, the rebels began to shout that if they would kill anyone who gave that signal. The captain gave the order to the senior mate, with the help of the guards, you're going to disperse the mutineers by force. Now, something happened at this point, which I don't understand. I read some of the transcripts from the trial, and I can't find an explanation. A rifle went off. This has happened before. It was actually a stoker on the forecastle, the raised deck at the bow. Fired his weapon at a seagull that was irritating him. That's a very strange story. I guess it's true. It hasn't been contradicted. It was a stupid thing to do. It could have been an accident. The shot was perceived as a signal to start shooting. So the artillery quartermaster, Pekolenchuk, I've already mentioned, fired at his immediate commander, the senior artillery officer, Lieutenant Lev Yupkoev, and he killed him. Volleys went back and forth from the battery room, the officers and disciplined sailors who were out in the open. They began jumping overboard or into the hatch leading into the ship's interior. Rebel sailors were on the attack, running onto the poop deck in the rear. The leader of the rebellion, Matyushenko, as I mentioned, Bekolenchuk, they ran ahead of everyone else. There was a senior mate, Gilyovsky, taking a rifle from one of the guards, fired twice at a mutineer who ran to the side of the battleship and fell into the water. Whether he was killed or whether he dove, I don't know. One of the divers, Papruga and Matyushenko, shot at Gilyovsky, wounding him. And then as he lay on the deck, they finished him off, the senior mate, with several shots and threw his body overboard. There were like 30 guys swimming in the water. The rebels started shooting at them with rifles. Now, this is ridiculous because they couldn't fight back. One of the shooters at the trial said he shot 40 rounds. And somehow they thought that, well, they had something to run away from. They're there because they're guilty or something like that. The truth is that those who jumped in the water were young sailors who got confused and jumped overboard because the bullets started flying. Four more officers were killed after this. A member of the Commission of Naval Artillery Experiments from the Naval Ministry, who had nothing to do with any of this, Lieutenant of the 12th Naval Crew, Nikolai Grigoryev, a navigation officer, the ensign, Livitsev, were also shot in the water. And then the captain himself was shot and killed. The captain at this point, before he was murdered, he wanted to blow up part of the ship, maybe shooting at the forward powder chamber, but they couldn't get to it because they knew that was a possibility. Alexeyev himself wasn't really a career officer anyway. He was a merchant ship guy. And the captain's body was thrown overboard. I'm not sure what blowing up the ship meant. I know the Russian word, and it means precisely that. It's not, you know, iffy. Now the captain was murdered. After his murder, a rumor spread, and this is all rumor-driven, that Lieutenant Ton, T-O-N, was going to blow up the artillery cellars, which is something that the captain was thinking of. Ton himself came out to the sailors. Matyushenko demanded that Ton, who was his immediate commander, remove his shoulder straps and insignia. Lieutenant replied, "You didn't give this to me. You can't take it off me." So he was murdered by Matyushenko. And he fell wounded, after which he was finished off with a shot to the head. His body also thrown overboard. So what do you do? Well, there's only one thing that the rebels can do. They could claim to be leftist revolutionaries and go to Odessa. They murdered the battleship's doctor, Smirnov. They found him and threw him overboard. There was some random shooting. There were innocent sailors who were shot. There was the engineer mechanic, senior engineer mechanic, Nikolai Savetkov, was arrested in the boiler room. The ship's priest, Father Potaman, was beaten with rifle butts, but he got away. Some of the officers who jumped into the water were able to swim to the artillery shield sailing nearby, where the destroyer was. They can get away that way. But on the destroyer, the shooting that they heard was perceived as evidence that the rebellion was over. They were killing them. The sailors who got there from it climbed on to the the inspector Mikado, for example, who climbed onto the destroyer. Finally, the destroyer captain, Claude von Jürgensberg, tried to weigh anchor and leave, but couldn't do it because the anchor machine broke down. So they just severed it, just released the whole thing, and left overboard. The destroyer began to reverse. There was a boat astern, the cable of which, having weakened, was wound around the rotating propeller, causing the destroyer to lose control. So on the Potemkin, again, this is all miscommunications. This is very, very bizarre. Seeing the torpedo boat's maneuvers, not realizing what was going on over there, fearing that those who had jumped overboard got to it, and now they're going to try to sink the Potemkin, shot some warning shots over the ship. And it backed down. Somehow they got it all under control. Rebels put their crew on board the torpedo boat when they overcame it, arrested the captain, transferred him to the Potemkin. So to think that torpedo boat, it didn't really have a name, it was just 267. The Soviets claimed that it joined the rebellion. It doesn't correspond to reality. That's what happened. It was a miscommunication they took advantage of. Eventually, the ship, of course, much larger than the destroyer, they got broadside and took it over very quickly. And usually by surprise, because no one knew what was happening. So at 1 p.m., the ship was in control of the rebels. Matyushenko was the main guy. He joined the left, the Social Democrats, back in 1904. He was one of the few that was actually conducting real revolutionary propaganda among the sailors, the general uprising of the fleet. He even said later, we had a schedule of who to get, who to kill, who to get rid of. So he said, if it weren't for the Borscht issue, we're going to kill these people anyway. That just gave us an excuse. That was just a very surprising thing. They were going to start this anyway. They were going to start shooting regardless. But later on, a lot of his former allies said that he was just an adventurer. He'd never really had any ideology. He never really had any principles. That he was just a criminal. And they created then a sailor's court. Now you can imagine how just this was. And the captured non-commissioned officers, and some both from the destroyer and from the Potemkin. Some of those who had joined with the rebels wanted to start shooting them anyway. But the majority said no. The battleship then declared itself the territory of free Russia. And they did, you know, what the left pretended to do. They had elected people. You know, they had elections for senior officers. And they put people in all the wrong spots. And only Alexeyev, the only one who was an ensign, they put in as a captain, because you couldn't just elect that. But everyone else was elected. So the ship was barely functional. So the entire Black Sea Squadron was expected at Tendra Island. So the mutinous battleship had to get out. So going to Odessa was there. They were going to replenish water, coal, food, whatever. They knew that a general strike was taking place. Now, that was the ship's only connection to Odessa. They knew the Jews had taken the city. Around 4 p.m., the Potemkin showed up and weighed anchor, the destroyer with it. Alexeyev, by the way, became captain only under duress. He didn't sympathize with anything. He said, I'm only going to take you as far as Odessa, then I'm leaving. I'll ask the Tsar for clemency, whatever, but I'm not doing any more. Belwenchuk died, by the way, in the hospital. And before he finished his speech, Alexeyev was shot. He was victim number 12, I think. Odessa was engulfed in a strike. And this was largely by coincidence. The Soviets, you know, pretended this was all one movement, but it wasn't. This would have happened. This ridiculous situation would have happened anyway. And according to what I just mentioned, they were going to start shooting regardless. But there weren't that many supporters on that ship. So what they did on June 14th, late at night, invite, quote, representatives of the city's social revolutionary organization on board. So they went to go and find them. The rebels kind of knew where they were. They needed fuel, provisions, and everything else. And by the Winchuk, they had this big funeral, making it into a revolutionary propaganda event. While they were there, they captured a transport ship who had no idea what was going on. The Emirates had a cargo of coal. Bakalenchuk, they placed it in a new pier. That was, they erected a tent for this. And by this time, the revolutionary groups were there. They didn't even know what happened, but they were talking about him was murdered by the captain, whatever story they were being told. It was the Mensheviks, Berezovsky, Vinogradov, Konstantin Feldman, and one Bolshevik, Ivan Lazarev. Everyone was a Jew. Now, the deputy prosecutor, Abraskovich, the chief of the Odessa Commercial Port, Gerasimov, a few policemen under the command of the assistant bailiff for the court, Fedorov, arrived on board the battleship. They wanted to find out what was going on, what happened, because there was tremendous confusion. If you weren't on the ship, even if you were on the ship, you didn't know what was going on. So they were willing to let them on, but they had to disarm. They had to throw their weapons overboard. Then eventually they drove the boat away from the battleship altogether. They elected a ship's commission of 30 sailors with Odessa Jewish revolutionaries who had never been on a ship before. And guess who actually ran the ship? And they're the ones who drafted appeals to the rebels, the garrison troops, and the citizens of Odessa with calls to begin the uprising. Now again, the police force in this place was very small. They couldn't prevent the uprising that began over this allegedly murdered man, the guy who was a part of this uprising. But of course, they invented a whole story about him. But by noon, right after that, Odessa Military District gave the command. Two infantry regiments of Cossacks surrounded the port. The troops were ordered not to enter the port itself, because the Jews who had taken over the battleship were threatening to open fire on the city and the troops if they began to act against anything that was going on in the port itself. Now, the Odessa Jews who had arrived on board tried to create their own marine force, the land troops in Odessa, to seize key facilities. But the so-called commission, they didn't like this idea. They wanted to wait for the squadron to arrive. Might have to fight with the entire crew. Now, another port ship, the Veka, which just arrived in Odessa and had no information at all what was going on, was captured by the rebel sailors. That was converted into a hospital ship, even though they had killed the doctor. Now, finally, the first person to report all of this to the Minister of Internal Affairs in Petersburg was the head of the Odessa Security Department, Mikhail Bobrov. A sailor named Mikhail Kondiega, who escaped in a rowboat from the torpedo boat. And he had been hiding during the entire passage from the island back to Odessa. And he gave the information as to what happened. That was forwarded to the Tsar Nicholas, who wrote in his diary. He said, "I have received stunning news from Odessa that the crew of the battleship Prince Potemkin that had arrived there has mutinied, killed the officers, and seized the ship, threatening disorder in the city. I simply cannot believe it." The Tsar ordered uprisings to be suppressed immediately. Every hour of delay may in the future result in streams of blood. Now, there's much about the Tsarist diaries that are forgeries. I don't know if that's true, but that's harmless enough that it may well be. Making matters worse, the Odessa authorities were frozen. The mayor was Nidgard, transferred all his power to the head of Odessa Military District, Sergei Kanov. He, in turn, appointed the brigade commander, Karangosov, as a commander of Odessa, and he didn't take any direct action. So nothing happened. You had several different military police forces that all were checking each other. Everyone thought someone else was going to do it. Well, and the Jews got the message. They had no problem in that department. So what happens in situations like this? A mob, a political mob, began to loot goods in the warehouse, breaking barrels. A crowd of drunks appeared. They set fire to barges, steamships. But soldiers, Cossacks, fearing artillery fire from the battleship, continued to remain. They only sealed the city off. Only when it was dark did the troops go on the offensive. Now, this later riot, which was not a pogrom, they don't even say it was. I mean, I think the Soviets may have tried to make it one. It was just the criminal elements in town. Remember, when the left takes over a place, they empty the prisons. So they had to create a prison system in Russia very late. The Soviets tried to claim 1,500 dead. But the Russian government official data say 123 people were killed. The Odessa police chief's report to the Odessa mayor stated 57 civilians had been killed, only 14 of whom had been identified. So now we're at June 16th. The rebels released and sent ashore all the arrested officers, except for the captain, the man they made captain, the ensign, Alexeyev, who was ordered by the ship's commission, quote-unquote, to perform his duties as a ship's captain. Two officers, Kovalenko and Lieutenant Kolizunov, remained on the battleship voluntarily. Everyone else was kind of released from arrest, and they just... Anyone else on that ship was there out of fear. And they took no action against the rebels. Because unlike the forces of order, the Jews who had taken over this ship from Odessa that were invited on immediately got everyone into shape and knew what they were doing. They were just outplayed at every level. Now, I mentioned the funeral of Bakulenchuk. The Soviets invented a story where, and this was repeated in the West, at the funeral, you had 30,000 Odessa workers took part in this. That was Feldman, by the way, who wrote that in his memoirs and who spread that everywhere. In official documents about the entire situation, that funeral wasn't mentioned at all. The writer's brother, Kurlienko, who watched the funeral procession from the balcony of his apartment, said about a dozen people followed the coffin. And of course, no workers were involved in these events at all. It was a completely invented story. It didn't work out like they wanted it to. No one knew who this guy was. It didn't matter, though. It's the perception. It's the propaganda that mattered. The ship fired three blank shots as per, like, you know, the gun salute in his memory. But it also fired two shots from the six-inchers with live shells at the city. So they used the, you know, 21 gun. They didn't shoot 21 times, but it was the same idea. The Jews were claiming that they wanted to hit the houses of the mayor and the commander of the troops, but they missed, of course, because they had no idea how to run these things. It was new to them anyway. But they used the mourning shots, you know, this you know, funeral shots, as an excuse. One shell hit the attic of a residential building in the central part of the city. There were no victims. One shot was a dud. By June 17th, the total number of troops in Odessa had reached 14,000, and still nothing was done. Lenin heard about all this from the newspapers, and of course, those were his newspapers. They were all supporting his point of view. And he sent his courier, the Bolshevik Mikhail Vasilov Yuzhin, to Odessa with instructions on how to expand all of this. And he said, try at all costs, get on the ship. Convince the sailors to act decisively and quickly. Ensure that a landing is made immediately. In extreme cases, do not hesitate to bombard government institutions. The city must be captured. Now, he arrived late. Didn't get there until June 20th. But he had orders from Lenin to get on that ship and say that the movement head in Geneva wants you to start a landing and to bombard the city. Whether he would have been listened to or not is another matter. But the Jews, Feldman, every other, all the rest who were on this ship, didn't really know how to work the equipment. But who knows what they would have done if they got Lenin's dictum? But that's what Lenin wanted to do. He was going to kill innocent people all over the place just for the sake of capturing the city. It was only the port area that had been taken. Then something happened. June 17th, there was an approaching squadron under the command of Vishnevsky. Potemkin turned to meet it, but the squadron turned away from the battleship and moved out towards the open sea. There were another squadron from Krieger. Vinishensky was an admiral. Those combined forces turned back to Odessa. The rebellious ship went out to meet them, passed through its formation without a problem. There was no firing. There was no nothing. The Potemkin turned around and went through the squadron again. And at that time, one of the battleships, Grigori Pobedonosets, had joined the rebellious battleship. I don't know on what basis. So by 5 p.m., both battleships now had arrived in Odessa and dropped anchor. That was considered the silent battle. The military is watching this take place. No one's shooting. Nothing is happening. Now they have another ship who, for God knows what reason, has supported this, the Potemkin. It was a silent battle because nothing had been done. The naval department never told anyone about the Pobedonosets going over to the side of the rebels. In fact, they thought that the Potemkin had surrendered to it. Now, there was no killing or anything else. It was just the captain who, you know, I don't think anyone even knew on the ship that it had gone over. I think it was just the captain because there was no killings or anything like that. A lieutenant had killed himself, so not to be involved. But Admiral Krieger and a few others who had been sent were worried about the reliability of his squadron. They were going to sink the rebel ships, but not with the groups that they had. They wrote a second appeal on the Potemkin to the commander of the Odessa Military District on behalf of the rebellious crew, and they're making these demands like they deserve to be in charge. The withdrawal of all government troops from Odessa, arming the people, which essentially means arming the Jews, and the establishment of popular rule. I don't know what, you know, obviously these are, they don't mean popular rule. What does that mean? It means the Jewish defense detachments are to be running the show without any interference from the state. The release of all political prisoners and the delivery of coal and provisions from the battleship. There were plenty who had refused to mutiny. On both the Pobedonosets as well as the Potemkin, they were a large number, and they had gained the upper hand. Many of the Pobedonosets, a lot of them didn't even know that they had joined this group. They didn't know what they were doing. They didn't know. There was just a captain and a couple of officers. The Potemkin was reloading coal from the captured ship, the Peter Rieger. The other ship, the Grigori, weighed anchor, announced by semaphore that it's leaving for Sebastopol and surrendered to the authorities about 5 p.m. Now panic set in on the Potemkin. Some wanted to open fire on the traitor ship, but the majority said, let's get out of here. Still with the destroyer 267, so the Pobedonosets, that was over. They went back to the state again. I don't know. That's a separate issue. We can't get into that now. They had to get out of the country. And they got to a place called Constanta, which is in Romania on the Black Sea. Two professional revolutionaries ran the Potemkin, Konstantin Feldman and A.P. Brzozowski, both Jews. While they were in Romania, they drafted an appeal to the entire civilized world that we are fighting to overthrow the autocracy. And I can't find a copy of this thing, by the way. I think it's very brief. I can't find a copy of it anywhere. But it's funny that they make a note that our actions, quote, don't pose any danger to the economic interests of foreign powers in the region. In other words, they clearly are being supported by a foreign power. Either Britain or France, probably Britain. But the fact that they would write their, essentially their manifesto, and mention that, go out of their way to mention that, is interesting. A lot of those ships, there was another one who went over to the rebellion, the Prut. There you did have some killings. The watch officer and boatswain were killed. Rebels sent the captured ship to Odessa, but Potemkin was no longer there. The Prut raised the red flag. But as soon as they went to Sevastopol, they ended the rebellion. They surrendered to the authorities. So to a great extent, the Potemkin was now alone. In the meantime, there was a destroyer, the Stremilny. That was manned exclusively by volunteer officers who wanted to take revenge on the mutinous crew for the murder of officers. On a destroyer, they went to Sevastopol to search for the Potemkin, to sink it, but they didn't catch up to it. It was out of the country at the time. Now, the Romanian government went to the Potemkin and said, "We'll give you the opportunity to surrender on terms of military deserters," which freed them from forced deportation to Russia and guaranteed their freedom, but they're not going to give coal or provisions or anything else. Romanian cruisers were ordered to open fire on any vessel attempting to enter the harbor without permission, which they did when torpedo boat 267 tried to enter the port in the morning. So they left. They had no choice. So they went to Feodosia, in Crimea. By this time, the ship had been decked out, you know, is like the red plywood on the side saying, you know, liberty, equality, brotherhood, long live the people's government, and this nonsense. A launch from the battleship landed at the city and immediately demanded provisions. Leon Durante was the mayor of Feodosia. He arrived on board the battleship, and they demanded, you know, pretty much everything, provisions, water, coal, or we're going to destroy your city. And they had to go along with it. They weren't sure whether they knew how to work these guns or not. Rebels handed the city authorities an ultimatum. We needed coal, or we destroy the city. 5 a.m., the mayor asked the residents of the city to leave. Martial law was declared. Troops were secretly brought into the port. At 9 a.m., a boat with a boarding party entered the port, and the sailors boarded the barges. Troops opened fire on the sailors, killing at least six rebels. A whole bunch of others jumped into the water and were captured. Again, you had a split on the so-called ship's commission. So this is this ship is essentially its own country at this point, run by two Jews who had no idea how to run a ship. They had killed anyone who mattered. So maybe we should destroy the city as punishment. So they went to Constantia again. They didn't shoot anything. That was it. They lost a few people. At that point, a squadron under Admiral Krieger was sent to Feodosia under orders to sink the rebellious battleship, which would be a shame. They didn't find them there because they had just left, and they returned back to Sevastopol. They were back in Constantia again. They said, "Okay, we'll do whatever you ask." The battleship's crew was taken ashore. Matyushenko had divided the cash box he had seized among all the sailors. And the sailors were resettled in various cities and villages of Romania at this point. The destroyer 267 then was free to leave and went back to Sevastopol. So the squadron arrived in Constantia on July 9th. This is after the fact. Took the Potemkin, delivered a new crew to it. Priests did a service of cleansing the ship. On July 11th, the Russian ship left Constantia. The Potemkin, which was returning 47 sailors and conductors and the previous crew. July 14th, the Potemkin was delivered to Sevastopol and recommissioned. So that's an adventure. But that was the situation in the revolutionary movement at the time. But as far as Odessa is concerned, one of the wealthiest parts of the empire, the city authorities estimated direct losses at almost 3 million rubles, which was half the annual budget of the city. You had warehouses and buildings burned down, lots of cargo in them, steamships moored at the berth were burnt. They had 3.7 million poods of new wheat. There was 36 pounds to a pood, so 36 times 3.7 million in terms of pounds. For export, never went. Commercial shipping was paralyzed in the Black Sea. So who was ever on their way, stopped at Constantinople, sold their cargo for next to nothing, wouldn't go any further. Terrified about what was going on there. Insurance companies refused to cover the losses because it was an act of God, they said, which is nonsense, but that's how they got away with it. So all the legal responsibility and financial authority was on the Russian authorities. All of this over a ridiculous set of rumors. But you can imagine what Lenin did with this information, what the regime continues to do with this information. The Western world, who despised Russia anyway, they were saying that, oh, it's so evil over there that even the Navy is protesting. The Russian Foreign Ministry didn't even secure the support of the Black Sea countries. You had Orthodox Royal Romania would not extradite the mutineers to Russia. Turkey refused the Russian government assistance it needed against the rebels and began to build up the minor artillery defenses in the Bosporus Strait. Of course, Russia was going to take Constantinople and the Straits in a future war. All of this made that impossible. All of Europe turned against Russia. Only Bulgaria was willing to work for it, but only if it was done in secret. Yeah, we'll extradite them, but no third countries can find out about it. I wonder who they're talking about. They're talking about Jewish Britain. And yet, Bulgaria owed its very existence to Russia. Almost all the available forces in the Black Sea were thrown into suppressing this uprising. To sink it, it wasn't carried out, thank God. But you had nothing, both on land as well as on sea. Indecisiveness, lack of information, lack of coordination, lack of confidence. The naval command showed utter confusion. The sailors, being very young and impressionable, were susceptible to revolutionary propaganda, opportunistic as it was, since they were in trouble anyway. I think for the most part, a lot of these guys feared being sent to the Far East. Regardless, even those who supported the uprising were all over the place on it. Very few of them were actual revolutionaries. The senior command staff were just killed. Of the surviving officers, three joined the uprising insincerely, and others simply were passive. So the trial began July 13th. Whether it be they should be tried under military law, Article 109, as mutineers, or criminal law, Article 100. Yet with a so-called revolutionary uprising and its political demands, the government just simply took it as a military mutiny. The Prut crew was put on trial. Only 44 sailors, 28 were convicted. Because it was wartime, a few were sentenced to death. The Georgi Popovets, that second trial, two leaders were sentenced to death. There were 53 defendants, life imprisonment or hard labor, a handful of others. So they weren't arresting, and that supports my theory that the crew didn't know what was going on. You had a huge battleship and a handful. They tried only 60 people. 54 actually. Trial of the Potemkin. The Tsar issued a decree October 21st, 1905, on the mitigation of punishments for political crimes committed before the publication of the manifesto October 17th. So they weren't sentenced to death. Death penalty was replaced by 15 years of hard labor. It was a big mistake. A whole bunch sent to prison companies. Ensign Alexeyev was dismissed from service. The instigator of the uprising, Fanasy Matsuenko, who I mentioned many times, he toured Europe as a celebrity. He illegally returned to Russia in 1907. He was arrested and he was executed, thank God. But most of that old crew lived in exile in Romania. 138 sailors returned to Russia at some point before the February Revolution. So 245 people, 31% of the crew from the original Potemkin, including those who refused to emigrate, returned to Sevastopol from Constantia. They returned to Russia. The rest remained in exile. Now, I got to wrap this up here. I mention this because, of course, Potemkin had absolutely nothing to do with any revolutionary movement. A couple of Jews from Odessa went on the ship and took it over. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized the left and the Jews were letting the world know exactly how they were going to run Russia when they take over. How is a Potemkin similar to the early USSR? If you consider the Potemkin a mini version of the USSR, I find the parallels pretty much everywhere. Number one, all actions were coercive. Force was the first and primary resort. They shot anyone who didn't agree. It's that simple. All violence and force, that was it. They didn't know how to work the equipment very well, but it was a battleship, and they used that perception to get away with things. Number two, Jews immediately took over the ship and spoke for it and organized the crew. That's the most important. Number three, it utilized propaganda constantly and invented stories as it went. Number four, it murdered whoever didn't go along. Number five, as I mentioned already, incompetent officers were in charge of the ship's operation, assuming that, well, anyone can do it. They were elected. That was more important than competence. Number six, the leftist movement wasn't important, but they were able to piggyback on other issues like the fear of going to war. Number seven, it was all based on false reports about Japan, let alone the false reports about the meat. Number eight, in Romania and Crimea, everything was accompanied by threats of bombardment. Number nine, the sailors were cannon fodder. Lenin wanted them to invade Odessa. But there was 12,000 troops there. 10, England was always in the background. England had a lot to do with this, more than I think Russian historians have dealt with so far. England was very threatened by this ship. The state had to be very careful on what they did, especially when, you know, these were mostly Jewish revolutionaries. England could shut down trade immediately, especially via Turkey. There was a lot they could do. England was used as a foreign threat against any reaction from the Russian state. They didn't see the absurdity in this, but they did. And finally, this is just off the top of my head, they used language in the most vague way imaginable, talking about popular government, workers, labor. That didn't refer to popular government, just meant their rule, their friends, Jews. I think there are many other parallels. The Potemkin was the future USSR. Very poorly run, but still was a battleship, and no one quite knew what they were capable of. Military counterintelligence really failed here. Cossacks, military personnel, all this on land didn't work well together. Truth is, the Jews outplayed the state in every way. See, they had no rules. They had no principles. And all these trials, the West condemned every one of them, even if it was just a few years imprisonment. Importantly, a major threat to British naval supremacy. It wasn't eliminated, but it was weakened. Potemkin meant that Russia was capable, contrary to all their mythology, of building an immensely powerful navy. And they were building other ships in the Baltic. But Russia also discovered how few friends they really had. Now, the state banned any discussion about the uprising until the trials were over, which makes sense, so the jury wouldn't be manipulated. The problem with that is that it just meant that any silly invention would just be believed, and rumors began to spread. The Black Hundreds were formed precisely out of this, the counter-revolution against the Jews in Odessa and elsewhere. The Jews continued to arm themselves, Jabotinsky and so many others, whether Zionists or socialists, and they were pretty much one and the same at this point. They were assassinating Russians, killing Russians regularly, and then claimed any reaction to it as a pogrom. And that's my understanding of the Potemkin mutiny of 1905. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.